Thank you. Great to be here, as always. I come before you as a seeker after truth and not as somebody who's decided what our future should be. It is indeed a challenge to try to figure out what the next step and the step beyond that would be. And so what I'd like to do today is to tell you some of the thoughts that arise out of recent meetings on the possibility of a muon collider. To be a good boy, I agreed to give a summary talk at a workshop at Fermilab. That was partly because the attention I'd paid to the idea of a muon collider before had been when the first new wave of interest came out. I did the couple hours of calculations that you do to figure out everything about it, assigned some problems to the kids in my class to work out about muon colliders, and then turned off for a couple of years. So I wanted to bring myself up to date on the thinking of other people, and that's why I agreed to give that talk. So this will be a version of it that's annotated for people who didn't sit through the previous 40 hours of talks at the workshop, and there'll be both advantages and disadvantages to that. So the first reason that one thinks of a muon collider as an interesting idea is that it might provide a path to a multi-TeV lepton collider that would enable us to address in a complementary way the great question, which is the mechanism for electroweak symmetry breaking, the difference between the weak and electromagnetic interactions. A second reason to pursue the idea is that it's conceivable that this could lead to a less costly way of building a modest energy lepton collider. And I'll summarize for you in a couple of minutes the essence of the argument that it might conceivably be a cheaper way to do that. The reason that we're looking for a path to a very high energy lepton collider is that, at least my assessment of the growth we might anticipate for a linear collider, makes it unlikely that that would be a good solution for arbitrarily high energies. It may well be that that's a technology that's appropriate over perhaps one order of magnitude of energy, a particularly interesting order of magnitude of energy, but may not be appropriate beyond that. And so it's nice to stretch your minds on these things. Once you've opened to the possibility of a muon collider, then there are many variations of it. A Z factory had a modest energy. A Higgs factory, which is a special feature of a muon collider, working at W threshold or top threshold, as you do and would talk about doing E plus E minus machines, building a machine of about a half a TeV to explore details of supersymmetry or technicolor or whatever is there, and then leading all the way to the very high energy collider. On the other side, in the non-collider mode, there are opportunities that are raised by the possibility of making and gathering up huge numbers of muons in the course of 1 year, the low-energy hadrons that you get from the proton source, low-energy muons, very intense neutrino sources, UP colliders, and on and on. And, of course, human inventiveness isn't very limited, so there are many, many of these combinations that have been thought about. Now, one of the amusing things about the workshop that was held in Fermilab in November was that this is a pretty new subject. A couple of hundred people showed up for the workshop, and it wasn't the same old recycled talks because there hadn't been a long line of these talks before. So people actually did some thinking and work. In 3 days, you don't do a lot of thinking and work, but at least there was something. And so there were some novel ideas and things that are worth pursuing. And while I don't know the answers in any dimension about muon colliders, there were a few things that came up in the course of the workshop that I think merit thinking about, and that I will spend some time thinking about and hope that some of you might as well. So let me start at the beginning. The muon is massive compared to the electron. It weighs 106 MeV, so about 207 times the mass of the electron. And the energy losses in a turn around a circle from synchrotron radiation are proportional for a relativistic particle to the inverse fourth power of the mass of the charged particle. So that means that synchrotron radiation is fantastically small for muons, whereas it is a limiting factor for electrons in circular machines. The muon is also an elementary lepton, as far as we know. You know the limits of that. And that means that the energy it carries is not shared among many partons, and so it's more efficient, as leptons are, than protons. Those two things taken together mean that a muon collider can be small. And to emphasize that it can be small, I mean a tiny picture, showing here the scale of Fermilab there. This is 10 kilometers across. Here's the LHC, 27 kilometers around. This is roughly the linear dimension of a linear collider to go to half a TeV or a TeV, about 30 kilometers. Here is a half TeV muon collider complex. Here is a 4 TeV muon collider complex. So these things can be small because they're efficient. You don't have to go to 40 TeV or 100 TeV. You can work at 4 TeV. And you can have a circular machine because you don't have a problem with synchrotron radiation. That smallness is the fundamental reason behind the hope that these things might be cheap. If there's a correlation between size and price, it is plausible or at least worth exploring the possibility that these machines might be cheap compared to their larger counterparts. If there weren't a piece of tape around this, I would take credit for destroying it. But not to be the first. So the great special feature or the great seduction of muon machines comes from the fact that it may be possible to build a machine that would do in formation in the S-channel production of the Higgs boson in the same way that we've made direct channel formation of the Z boson at LEP and at SLAC. You'll remember that the peak cross-section for E plus E minus goes to a Higgs boson is little, and the reason it's little is that the width for the Higgs to decay into E plus E minus is proportional to the mass of the electron squared. That's a little number. And so for a Higgs mass of in the accessible range, 100 GeV or so, the peak cross-section is 2 times 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared per GeV squared, but you integrate that only over a few MeV because the width of the Higgs boson overall is small. So that's a hopeless way to ever think about making or studying the Higgs boson. And that's the reason that the searches that are now carried out at E plus E minus machines at LEP2 rely on associated production, and E plus E minus goes to Higgs plus C, where we only have big couplings and nothing that's proportional to the small mass of the electron. Well, it's clear that muons are much better because the cross-section there is the square of the muon mass divided by the square of the electron mass is bigger, and that's a factor of 43,000. So the first observation you make when you think about a muon collider is that this is a big factor. And then the hard question, not yet resolved, in particular because there are no existence proofs for these machines, is whether it's big enough to make the S-channel formation reaction useful. Those are the advantages of muons. On the other hand, there are disadvantages. The muon is not... Yeah, and I'll speak to that in just a moment. So the disadvantages are that the muon is not free. You don't get it out of a bottle the way you do for protons and electrons. On the other hand, it's not so hard to make them because muons are made readily in pion decay, and pions are easy to make. The big challenge is that muons are unstable. They decay into an electron and pair of neutrinos in 2.2 microseconds, which means you've got to move fast to capture the muons that you've made, cool them in six-dimensional phase space, accelerate them, and then use them. And because with whatever gamma factor you can think of, time is going to pass quickly enough, you have to replenish the supply very rapidly. So those are challenges to the accelerator builder. Other challenges to the experimenter are the fact that the decay products complicate the experimentation. You've got this rain of electrons coming from muon decay in your detector, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a moment. And it's even the case that as you go to high energies and high numbers of muons, there becomes a radiation hazard from the neutrinos. Now, it's not directly from the neutrinos, because if you think of a, say, 100 GeV neutrino, that has an interaction length of about 25 million kilometers of water. And so 1 in 10 to the 11th interacts on the way through your body. That's not much to worry about. What is a problem is that the neutrinos coming through the Earth have a couple kilometers or so till they get to the surface in which they can produce muons, and it's the rain of those muons produced by the interactions that's noticeable. That dose is proportional to the length of a straight section divided by the depth of the machine times the current of muons times the cube of the energy of the muons. And it becomes noticeable if you store a millimole of muons over the course of a year at about 250 GeV. So it's not crippling, but something that one has to begin to pay attention to. So just one more word about the backgrounds. If we were to pick a 2-on-2 TeV collider, the ultimate aim, with a typical number of muons per bunch, about 2 times 10 to the 12th, you readily calculate that in each meter that those muons pass, about 2 times 10 to the 5th of them decay. The average energy of the electrons is 700 GeV, and so you're getting a flood of these energetic electrons illuminating the machine, the detectors, and so on. And that means it's not trivial to use these things.
How far away from the target do you see?
It really depends. If the neutrinos come through the air, there's never any problem. If they come through the Earth, there is a problem, and so you have to think about shielding or getting some depth. It's a problem that seems to be pretty easy to handle up to a few TeV. At about 2 TeV at any reasonable depth, there is a problem with what people have started calling the disk of death, which is just a disk of muons coming out at all directions from the machine. These things are only a problem if you stay there the whole year having your picnic, and then you get more than the federal requirements or limits on radiation. It's clear that people have to think about how to deal with that. And that's right. Well, interplanetary, for that matter. Right? So at the current level, it's kind of an amusement, but it's something that people will have to pay attention to if this ever happens. You know, you just put it up in the air, and then you don't have to worry about it. So there was a workshop at Fermilab in November, a couple hundred people, 9 working groups, 4 of them having to do with the front end of the machine, and I'll explain what that is, 4 having to do with various topics in the colliders. And as a parameter, I give you that Bob Palmer, one of the fathers or stepfathers of this movement, imagines that the first muon collider could come into being in 2010. Since Palmer is not known to be a pessimist, that's a parameter we should keep in mind. So, what is the front end? The front end first consists of a high-intensity proton source, because it takes lots of protons to make lots of muons. There are a couple of example designs floating around. One for Fermilab involves a 16 GeV proton synchrotron operating at 15 hertz, so very rapid cycling. It would be used to produce 2 bunches of protons, about 5 10 to the 13th each in every cycle, so 15 times a second. And that means about 1.5 times 10 to the 22nd protons per year, about 1,000 times the number of protons currently accelerated to 8 GeV at Fermilab in a year. This is not a machine that exists, but so it's not quite within current practice. It seems to be within current designs for people who talk about neutron sources, tritium production machines, and things of that sort. So it's something that the accelerated people are confident they could make. Next, you have to make pions. That requires a target that can survive the hot beam. Collect the pions and allow them to decay. The main feature for doing that is to confine the pions in a high-field solenoid, because that makes them curl around and not go away. After that, there's a 20-meter decay channel in itself in a large solenoid to keep the muons that come out in a spiral. And in the end, it looks like you could get about 1/5 of a muon for every proton, 1/5 of a muon for each charge. So that looks pretty efficient. And that would give 10 to the 13th muons per cycle. These things, of course, are the result of calculation, not yet of experiments. And there are some experiments going on, principally at Brookhaven, to really measure the production cross-section of pions and follow these things through so these parameters are more reliably known. That would then allow, at this production stage, the collection of about 10 to the 21st muons of either charge per year. So a big number. Then you need to, since these muons are produced at various angles and with various momenta, You need to cool them so they have a little volume in phase space. The scheme imagined for that is called ionization cooling. And I'll give you a cartoon of what that's about. In the simplest version, if we imagine this brown line to be the momentum vector in longitudinal and transverse space for the muon, you allow it to go through a bit of matter. These are muons of a couple hundred MeV over C. Allow it to go through some matter. It loses momentum in both dimensions. And then you accelerate it in an RF cavity to add to the longitudinal momentum, and you can see that the ratio of transverse to longitudinal gets reduced by that. You do this many, many times to try to collimate it as much as possible. A variation on this, which is necessary to bring the spread of longitudinal momenta into line, is to make a region of high dispersion so that there's a correlation between momentum and position, and arrange for the things of high momentum to go through a lot of material, the things of low momentum to go through less material. So in my cartoon, this is a perfectly designed wedge which changes everything to have exactly the same momentum vector afterwards. And then you do the same thing. The simulations indicate that you could compress the phase space by a factor of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6th before the multiple scattering noise induced by going through this material starts to bite you. Don't understand how you can do that. At what level don't you understand how you can do that?
I don't see why they should do spatial
separation. Oh, you just have it go through some magnetic system. You know, it's a region of high dispersion, so it's a like a channel in an accelerator, a high beta piece.
Okay. Yeah? Can you say something about what are the main uncertainties in these simulations of ionization cooling?
It's never been done. I think that's the main uncertainty.
Okay. I'm not sure I think that really answers my question, though. Certainly from an engineering point of view, but I'm trying to interpret the measured quantities that need to go in or the physical effects that need to be simulated. Have they identified what aspects of, you know, I mean, of VEDX and so forth, we don't understand very well, or is it?
You'd think, and this has in common with the problem of crystal channeling, say.
Yeah.
You'd think this is something that you know how to calculate, and that the calculation should be reliable. It's just electrodynamics at some point. So unless there's some effect that's been left out, or some effect due to the high density of the beams, it ought to be something they can get right.
We get data ejection out of retirement. And, you know,
if you could get him to finish proofreading the third edition. My son asked me last night, he said, Dave is getting pretty old. Can he still do all the problems in Jackson? Must be true that he can. But yes, it's an electrodynamics calculation. It shouldn't be hard to get right, we hope. Finally, you need a muon accelerating system, and the example given in designs is a system of recirculating LINACs. And I'm not going to show you a vast parameter list, but I want to show you that one because it has some important features. In this case, there are three. A recirculating LINAC is a linear accelerator, an arc, another linear accelerator, an arc, and back, and so on. The first one goes from 1 to 10 GeV, the second from 10 to 70, the third from 70 to 250. Notice that the number of turns that the muons live in each of these is quite limited, 9, 11, 12, and that the decay losses, although not crippling, are not trivial either, 9% in the first, 5% in the second, 2.5% in the third. So here's a picture of the main elements in an example of such a machine. This one has one of everything in it. The proton source, pion production and capturing, pion decay, that was a solenoid, the muon ionization cooling channel, and then a series of accelerators of various kinds to take the muons quickly to high enough energy that you can use them before you lose them. I don't know that that's established. not very high Z, because and you want the thing that you fight against is multiple scattering, but I don't know if that's chosen. There's also a lot of uncertainty about what the target material can be. It has to have high heat conductivity to survive, and so there are various proposals to use things like liquid sodium and so on.
Now, at this stage, you have both mu plus and mu minus.
If you like, one of the schemes they talk about is to use alternate bunches for mu pluses and mu minuses.
So you can use the same.
That's right.
And that's easy to
on the scale of these things. Yeah. So I said it was small and therefore might be cheap, but we have to bear in mind that while it's small, there are lots of pieces to it, and all the pieces have to work. So here is superposed on some of the Fermilab apparatus the idea of a proton LINAC, the 16 GeV booster, coming over here through the cooling channel, the linear accelerators, all the stuff to accelerate muons and so on. So you see there are lots of little pieces. And so the tension here is between the small size, which might make it cheap, and the complexity, which isn't grossly different from other accelerators we know about. They all have lots of pieces, but there are a significant number of complicated pieces here. Okay, so that's all I want to say about the idea of the accelerators. It seems to me, in trying to take stock of where we are and where we need to be on this subject, that there are a number of very significant questions which you could apply not just to muon colliders but to anything we think of for the future. First, what machines can we actually build? When might it be possible to build them? What do they cost? What are the physics opportunities? And that's the main issue that was discussed at this workshop. Discussed a little bit at the workshop, but not in the same detail, was whether it's possible and how it's possible to do physics in this environment with the flood of decays that are taking place. And then it seems to me that the real big question for all future accelerator projects is not just what we'd learn from them if we had them today, but if you project to the time when we might plausibly have them, what's actually going to be added to knowledge there. And that's something that's easy to overlook, easy for partisans to overlook, and so we have to keep it in mind. So let me start first with the Higgs factory, which is, if you think that it's interesting and important to go to many TeV with a lepton collider, and it might be possible, you still have to ask yourself, in terms of physics and machines, how would you get started, and how would you take the first step toward getting there? So one idea that's become very popular with at least a small number of enthusiasts is the idea of a Higgs factory in which you would use the reaction mu plus mu minus goes to Higgs goes to BB bar. So this assumes to be useful that the Higgs boson is light. And that is because if the Higgs mass is bigger than two W masses, so you can have a real decay into gauge bosons, it rapidly becomes broad, and this sort of device doesn't have a particular advantage for it. So it has to be light. That's consistent with the indications, but we can't overread the indications from precision electroweak measurements. It assumes that somebody else has found the light Higgs boson so that when you build this machine, you know what size to make it and you know where to start looking for it. And it's reasonable to assume that, especially on the time scale of 2010 or so, that that might be known to 100 or 200 MeV if we're lucky. Here's a compilation of what we think is possible for uncertainties in the Higgs mass at the various accelerators that have a chance of finding a light Higgs boson. So LEP is operating now, LEP 2 is operating now, and could in the course of the next year or so find a Higgs boson up to 95 or 100 GeV, maybe a little beyond, with an uncertainty in mass on the order of a number of hundreds of MeV. So these are the two dots here, connect those points. If the Tevatron were to have a high integrated luminosity run in the years just before the LHC operates, it would be possible there to find a Higgs boson up to a mass of about 130 GeV in associated production, but with an uncertainty on the mass, which is on the order of a few GeV. If the observation is made at the LHC, Then for a light Higgs boson, the preferred detection mode is in two photons, requires exquisite resolution to find the signal at all, and therefore you know the mass to within 100 or 200 MeV. So this is a reasonable guess for what you might need to know. So then the idea is that you build a machine to sit on the Higgs boson mass and make it. Two modes are discussed. One is a machine with a modest luminosity of a 20th of an inverse femtobarn per year, with a very high resolution on the momentum of about 3 times 10 to the minus 5. Then there's a higher luminosity, or sort of normal luminosity version, that gives about 0.6 inverse femtobarns per year, with a resolution and momentum of about 1 in 1,000. The high resolution is interesting because this number translates into a 2 or 3 MeV uncertainty in the mass that you make in the machine, and that's the same size as the Higgs boson mass in the standard model for around 100 GeV or so. So that's a nice match. So the scheme that people have imagined is for a light enough Higgs boson, not too close to the Z, where you have trouble distinguishing them, you take what's known from other accelerators and divide that by your resolution, and so scan a large number of points, 50, 100 points, with enough luminosity that you could see who's up and who's down, and by that device, zero in within one machine resolution on the mass of the Higgs boson. Now, that's non-trivial, and the estimates that have been made so far suggest that you need about 0.15 inverse femtobarns to do that, and with the parameters of luminosity used at the Fermilab workshop, that takes about 3 years of running. So, you know, 3 years is not 30 years, it's not completely nuts, but it's not what you'd like either. So another factor of 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 in luminosity would certainly be desirable to make that more interesting. So the scheme then would be that you find the thing, and then you sit on it and just off it and make a precision scan to measure the parameters of the Higgs boson. Which two parameters? Oh, it's just what you have to do in the optics in order to get the resolution down. Basically means more diffuse beams. It's basically just squeezing the beta functions are different in the two accelerators. So let me show you a little bit about these machines. Again, the main parameters are the ones that we've seen, the uncertainties in the momentum, and the number of turns that you live is about 800 in machines of this kind. So every 15th of a second, you do it again. So then the idea would be that you run for a long time sweeping out the line shape of the Higgs. That's something that you can't imagine doing anywhere else. And in the right amount of running, you could determine the mass to within a tenth of an MeV, which is amazing. You could measure the width to about half an MeV, which is about a sixth of the expected natural width of a standard model Higgs boson. That's a discriminant for supersymmetry, because in supersymmetric models, it's possible, even likely, for the mass of the thing that seems like the standard model Higgs boson, the lightest Higgs boson, to be twice or five or even more than 10 times the standard model value. It's also possible to make pretty good measurements of the cross-section times branching ratio into BB bar and W plus virtual W. And these two are parameters that in their ratio are sensitive to some aspects of supersymmetric models. In minimal supersymmetric models, this ratio is basically determined by the mass of the pseudoscalar Higgs boson. As the pseudoscalar Higgs boson goes up to infinity in mass, you recover the standard model value, and you get deviations from it that can be quite substantial as that becomes a light particle. So you can imagine that by determining that, you find something beyond the standard model and zero in on the pseudoscalar mass, which you could then go and sit on itself, and U plus B minus goes to the A particle. So with the current estimates, that requires about 0.4 inverse femtobarns, which is about 8 years of nominal running. Again, not 100 years, but it's a long time. So my view of these things is that I understand the theoretical source of the enthusiasm for these things because they're impressive measurements and ones that would be interesting to know, but a boost in luminosity by, say, a factor of pi would give a great improvement to the appeal of doing a thing like this.
Can you comment on positives?
Yeah, let me come to that in a bit. Now, one of my conclusions at the workshop was these things are luminosity poor, you've got to do better. After the fact, the workshop organizers said, well, you know, we in fact reduced the parameters by a factor of 2 or 3 just to test you guys and to see if you really wanted high luminosity and so you can have it back. So I felt very powerful that by giving one talk I could raise the luminosity of these machines by a factor of 3. And I hope that's right. But you see that these are sort of on the edge of being really interesting. And then there's a secondary question of if it takes till 2010 to do this, we might not be as fired up to have the first indications so that the Higgs boson is supersymmetric. These comet. These are still just theorist simulations. So I think that cuts both ways. Experimenters are always smarter than theorists about doing analysis. They're particularly smarter after they have data. So this may be pessimistic because it's sort of stupid and plotting the way the analysis has been done. Forgive me, boys. On the other hand, the experimental realities haven't been confronted by people who actually have to live with them. That got a little attention at this workshop, but it's clearly an area. You know, we're at the place where factors of 2 or 3 in the practicality really matter, and so that has to be thought about much more. So what are those experimental realities? See, Dave has been pawing through my transparencies in advance. One is, well, it's been important at LEP to have good measurements of luminosity, energy, and polarization. At LEP, the luminosity has been measured in Baba scattering, E plus E minus to E plus E minus, with small angle monitors. In the case of these machines, the default design of the experiments has been to just give up on a cone of 10 or 20 degrees around the beam line. That means Baba scattering is not, or the analog, is not the thing you're going to use to find a luminosity monitor. And in fact, no demonstrated luminosity monitor at the level of 1 per mil, which is what you'd like, has been invented yet. So that's something that people need to work on. On the other hand, the energy and polarization look like they're in good shape, because there you can use the fact that the muons, as they will be captured, naturally have some degree of polarization, typically about 20%, given the momentum bite that you would accept. And it's a curious fact of nature that in a ring to confine muons at the mass of the Z, the muons basically flip their spin once every turn by the usual precession. And so you can measure the electron spectrum and distribution from muons turn by turn, see it change, and the frequency with which it changes tells you gamma, since you know G minus 2, and the amplitude of this change tells you how polarized they are. So that looks like it actually does itself, and does itself in real time while you're doing the experiment. That's kind of cute. So the backgrounds, as I said, have led people to give up on a cone around the beam line and certainly make it challenging to operate silicon vertex detectors near the beams. And how you would solve that, since after all we're looking for Higgs into BB bar here, whether you do that just by backing off a little and giving up a little on resolution or you have to find some other solution isn't clear yet. And that's the sort of thing that needs thought. Okay. Now, I wanted to show you that while everybody's been looking for the Higgs boson, my daughter actually found it. She was in London last year, and in the Virgin Megastore near Piccadilly, she found this object. It's the Higgs boson CD. And it turns out that Mr. Boson is a classically trained keyboard artist. copyrighted to. And he's got, you know, his music has names like Perpetual Symmetry, Big Technology, so on. And one of my students pointed out to me that if you turn his logo like this, you can see the famous double well potential. So obviously this is very deep. So, synthetic spring, but that could be the step beyond brains for all we know. So it's good to have attentive children. All right, so that's my reading of the current state of the art on the Higgs factory. Given the luminosities that people talk about doing, certainly interesting to think about. It's not, to me, guaranteed that this is a machine that you would die to have. But I think we can sort of calibrate what the standards would be.
The Higgs factory essentially, there's nothing concrete to measure.
That's right. And what you have to assess, I mean, first it's amazing you could think of doing it. And then you have to ask yourself, would you really invest some number of years, whether it's 4 or 12 or whatever, in doing this? And you know, that depends on what you think the state of our knowledge is going to be at that time. There's certainly things that it could measure that nothing else could measure. But if you could actually find a way to use this information to then zero in on the pseudoscalar and go there with another machine and all of that, you can imagine being carried along by it.
It's very different than the feedback. There are very few involved.
That is true. I think that's right. That the you know, you can say we sat on the Z for 7 years. It's sort of embarrassing that only the data up to 1992 have actually been published on most things. But there are 21 or 22 measurements there and lots of opportunities for discoveries that didn't happen that tell us something. So this is interesting, but probably not in the same bread and butter category that was. Yeah?
What does the bump look like on top of the top of everything else?
How big is the bump? I have a picture that doesn't quite answer the question, but here it is. So this is a bump with not quite all the running I talked about. And you can see there may be 1,000 events or a little less in that peak. This is what you get after a year and a half or so of running. Okay, so after 3 years of running, the estimate is that you would have about 3,000 events, 2,500 in BB bar, equal background. So, I mean, that's the thing. It's taken you this time to zero in well enough to then sit there and really grind on it. And as I say, if you can do that in 1 year or half a year instead of 3 years, it becomes a lot more appealing. So let me move on to some other topics for the colliders now. People talk about measuring W parameters very well by building a machine at W threshold. It's basically not interesting. The measurements will have been made well enough there. Going to TT bar threshold, there's this canonical set of things that we know about from linear colliders, and then going up into the continuum and doing supersymmetry and stuff. I won't give you the details of the parameters. The luminosities talked about, the average luminosities, which are much lower than the peak luminosities because the muons are decaying, of course, are a few times 10 to the 32 per square centimeter per second for those machines. They typically lag the advertised numbers for linear colliders by about an order of magnitude, and there's no particular advantage of one over the other, so it's a question of which machine gets you the most luminosity. And the muon colliders are losing on that score at the moment. Let me make brief comments about some of those things. Supersymmetry, we've all heard the story in endless detail for linear colliders, and it's basically the same here. There are lots of possibilities for detailed studies at half a TeV. Luminosity is an issue, especially for sleptons. Sleptons are important because those are things that you'd like to do well in a lepton machine that you can't do well in a hadron machine. The uses of polarization are different in detail here. In a linear collider, you probably have one beam polarized very highly. Here you have both beams polarized 20%, 30%, 40%. You can probably control that polarization independently, And so you have different knobs to twist, but on balance, it's this sort of the same thing. So it's basically a variation on the linear collider theme. And as I say, it will boil down to a question of who's got the best luminosity, and then after that, the experimental conditions. I did learn something that was maybe of interest to some of you at this workshop that was new about supersymmetry. There was at some point some very learned theological debate about the relative merits of breaking supersymmetry with gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking or the standard minimal supergravity schemes, which went on for a long time because there was no resolution, after which one of my postdocs came up to me and pointed out that in Irish, sugra is a very common phrase meaning children at play. So since everything was so much like the linear collider case, that's all I learned about supersymmetry. But that's a well-known story. Basically, the same is true about strong dynamics. This comes back to Tony's question. For strong dynamics, so technicolor variations on that, top color, and so on, if a machine like this has anything to say, it means that the dynamical symmetry breaking scale must be rather low, same as for the Higgs boson. If it's heavier, you're not going to do it here. If that's the case, then for most of the possibilities, it's a lot like the linear collider case, or even the hadron collider case. So if you think of making the techni vector mesons, the techni rho and techni omega, as an E plus E minus for light scale technicolor, you would have lots of events, 10 to the sixth events for the a reasonable luminosity here, decaying into W pi or Z pi, things like that. The thing that's unique to the muon collider is just parallel to the Higgs case. There are things, a couple of neutral techni pions, which would decay prominently into BB bar and which generically couple to mass. And since the muon mass is big compared to the electron mass, these are signals that you could see here that you couldn't see readily in the plus E minus machine. So if you knew technicolor were true and you found a technipion elsewhere, you could set up a technipion factory in the same way that you make a Higgs factory. Yes, in all these respects, these have to be thought of as follow-up experiments. As you find this fantastic sector, and then you look at it in detail in this machine. It's both for time scale and for the machines that we know we have and the reach they have. That's a follow-up thing. Yes, you're certainly not going to find the light Higgs
right.
here.
When we looked at that rather unimpressive mass plot of the light Higgs,
this
we're
is
supposed to look at that as not a discovery, but as trying to measure its width.
Trying to pin down its mass so you can then measure its width.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Let me say a little bit about muon collider possibilities. You know, you've got all these rings around, and so people can think of them. It's clear if you think of high-energy muons, high-energy protons that are sitting nearby, you get to large Q squared. Luminosities would be pretty reasonable, about 10 to the 33. That's in 1 year, 10 times the luminosity that Hera will have integrated in its lifetime, so it's nothing to sneeze at. Because of the kinematics and the angular cutoffs in the detectors, you wouldn't do much at low X, but high Q squared is obviously something that you could explore very well. And so here are two examples of that. In 1 year, you would get in charge current a million events above Q squared of 5,000. Zeus has 326, so it's just a question of reach and events. If you're looking for pink elephants, you could think about making squarks and R-parity violating interactions using the second generation, which you're not going to get at very well elsewhere. And again, there's an enormous reach for these things. So, I mean, these are sort of kinematics plots, and it's clear that you don't build a muon collider only so you can do mu p scattering, but if you have the muon collider apparatus, you might think of bringing the two together. Okay. That was for 200 GeV muons on the Tevatron, right? Okay, now let me come to the part of the workshop that I found novel and stimulating that didn't have to do with colliders but with the use of the stored muons that you would make either on their own or on the way to building a collider. And the most interesting of these have to do with the neutrino sources that would come from the stored muons, which you can imagine making with energies of a few GeV up to 100 GeV or more. Depending on whether you have a mu plus or a mu minus, you get an interesting mix of mu neutrino and electron antineutrino or the other way around. And with 10 to the 20th or so muons per year, you get a lot of them. And they make it possible to contemplate very interesting oscillation studies over extremely long baselines and to do deep and elastic scattering, not in the massive targets we're accustomed to for neutrino scattering, but in very thin targets. So let me go through that quickly. I suspect every future theorist did this when you had to learn to calculate muon decay and where the electrons went. Out of perversion, you calculate where the neutrinos would go in angle and energy. So here's where the muon antineutrinos from mu plus decay go, mostly with high energy and mostly in the direction correlated with the spin of the mu plus. And a similar calculation for the electron neutrinos lands them in the opposite direction and with a fraction of the momentum, the maximum momentum they can have. So there are two parts to this story. One has to do with high energy stored muons for deep and elastic scattering. The second has to do with oscillations. People looked at two options for the high energies. One was just to use this third recirculating linear accelerator that in 12 turns or something went from 70 GeV to 250 GeV, use the LINAC itself as a place where muons can decay, and so 600 meters downstream of that you build your neutrino detector. And what you find, is, since that's pretty long, it's half a kilometer long, is that the mean energy is about 135 GeV. That's because the muon energy is stepping up every time, so on every turn you get a different energy spectrum. It's very well collimated. About half the neutrinos are within this size, 600 meters downstream. The other possibility is to use the 250 GeV muon collider ring, just put in a straight section of that or not, and take the decays that come from that. There you get the full energy reflected in the neutrinos, about 180 GeV for the neutrino energy, and about 50% of the neutrinos are within a smaller space, 15 centimeters or so, 600 meters downstream. That's about 1,000 times the present rates that are seen in the detectors at Fermilab. With those rates, you find that the present detectors are all wrong. Here's a simulation made in the NUTEV detector, the current version of the famous CCFR detector at Fermilab, which the main meat of it is 690 tons, of which 420 or so are the fiducial volume. In one turn around the recirculating linear accelerator, you get about 6 charge current events in that apparatus with 4 muons or so going through it. So that's not the way to do things, and you quickly figure out that instead of having this great mass of stuff, you could have a very thin target instead. So at 600 meters from this recirculating linear accelerator number 3, in a 1 meter long liquid hydrogen target, you would get the same number of events per year as you do today in the massive detector. What could you do with that after you get over being astonished? Well, you could measure parton distributions directly in protons rather than in iron. Well, that's what we want. That wouldn't be a bad thing to do. The neutral current to charge current ratio, which is effectively a measurement of the W mass, is known to zero statistical precision, basically. So you get down to 20, 30, 40, 50 MeV for the effective W mass. And by reconstructing about 100,000 charms per year, you could finally get a respectable direct measurement of ECB and also get after the strange and anti-strange Cs in the proton. So there's a lot that could be done there, and in many cases here, the first reaction is astonishment that you could do it, but then you have to ask, do I really want to know these things? Would it change my life if I knew them, and so on? I will say that for myself, I was amazed to hear this possibility of having a thin target or even a polarized target, because a few years ago, Eichten and Hinchliffe and I had made a prediction that I was sure could never be tested, and that was in our chiral quark model interpretation of the flavor asymmetry in the C, the fact that there are more D quarks than U quarks in the proton C. A corollary of that is that the strange C should be negatively polarized, and the anti-strange C should be unpolarized because it's bound up in a Goldstone boson. So this must be true, but I never thought there would be even a conceivable possibility of doing it. And now you could think of doing deep and elastic scattering on a polarized target and showing that how wise we were or something. Okay, so that's one line. The second line has to do with neutrino oscillations. Here we want to exploit the fact that the neutrino beams from muon decay have a very special character. For mu minus, you get a mu neutrino and an electron antineutrino, but not muon antineutrinos or electron neutrinos or tau neutrinos or antineutrinos. So they're very clean compared to conventional beams. One of the things that cripples us, for example, in looking for nu e to nu tau oscillations is that we don't have hot electron neutrino beams from accelerators. The only source we have is electron antineutrinos from reactors, which aren't energetic enough to make taus. So you would have the possibility of looking for those things. And the cute feature is that since you've got muon neutrinos and electron antineutrinos, then unless the world is really perverse, just by discriminating against the charge of the electron that's produced, you know whether it came from a neutrino or an antineutrino, and so you can distinguish between nu mu to nu e oscillations and nu e bar to nu mu bar oscillations. And you could also do appearance experiments for the taus at high enough energies. Now, it's an old idea to think of using muons as a source of neutrinos to do neutrino physics. What's new about it is the vast number of muons that you can now contemplate doing, and that changes it from something that program committees through the years have agonized over and then rejected to something that at least program committees will have to agonize over again in the future. So here are some examples of what you could do. You could build a muon storage ring that had two arcs of the natural size to confine the muons of a given energy, plus straight sections, each of which has the same length as one arc. That's sort of a rough optimum. That way you get 25% of the muons decaying in the direction of your detector. And the typical length of these straight sections is not so big. For a 40 GeV muon ring, it's about 75 meters. So that means that up to the largest energies you might think of, a couple hundred GeV, this is a fairly compact device. And therefore, you can tip it down to an arbitrarily large angle because you're still not going very deep in the Earth. In contrast to neutrino beams pointing on the other side of the Earth where you have to channel down 3 kilometers in order to give this decay space. Moreover, in the usual way, because you know what the muons are doing, you can calculate the flavor composition of the spectra precisely. So here's an example that got my attention. It's worked out by Steve Geer. You could actually imagine building a long baseline experiment to go from Fermilab to the Gran Sasso laboratory. That requires going down at an angle of 51 degrees, but you're only going down 75 meters. Who cares? It's 10,000 kilometers away, and you find that if you have a 20 GeV muon beam, and if you're going to do long baseline, the reason is to maximize length over energy, so there's a premium on going to low energy. So with 20 GeV muons, you get a few times 10 to the 10th neutrinos per square meter per year. For reference, the Fermilab deep and elastic scattering experiment gets 10 to the 10th per meter squared per minute. And so this is a big difference of 5 orders of magnitude, but it's very far away and you're doing a different sort of experiment. It's about 200 times bigger if you point at Sudan, and that would be 10 times the time flux for the Minos experiment. That would then give rise to a significant number of charge current events in the Gran Sasso detector. For 20 GeV muons, you could expect to get about 100 events in the Gran Sasso per year, nu mu's turning into mu pluses. So the oscillation experiment is to look for E pluses, or with somewhat higher energies, to look for tau pluses, and so on. And you can see as you go up to higher energies from a combination of collimation and cross-section factors, you get many more events. So again, this is one of these things, and I think my general reaction to the large number of stored muons giving neutrino beams is one of astonishment that you could do these things. I mean, these are things that we haven't contemplated doing before, both for the deep inelastic scattering and for the very long baseline neutrino oscillation experiments. And I find that well worth thinking about. Would the physics actually be good? Would we learn a lot from doing any of these things? And I'm intrigued by the possibility that as a step for Fermilab or for the world, before you know whether you can build a 4TeV muon collider, and maybe without mastering all the cooling technology that you need to get the high luminosities that seem to be a bottleneck for those, you could still acquire and store these vast numbers of muons and use them for neutrino physics. So I think that's a very interesting area to think about over the next couple of years and to understand what sort of investment it would take in time and money to do that. Maybe there's an exciting physics program that can be done in the next 5 or 7 years rather than the next 20 or 40 years. So let me conclude with my general impressions of the workshop. I think overall I came away with the impression that while I'm not levitating, at least not yet, for the notion of a muon collider, that this is pretty serious. The ideas are interesting from the point of view of accelerator physics and the possibilities they raise. And the physics possibilities that you can see, while not dynamite yet, are within factors of being quite interesting and certainly bear more thought. So, conclusion I've already stated to you that for the machines that are variously discussed as the first muon collider or, to steal the acronym, the next lepton collider, all seem luminosity poor to me, and a factor of 3 or 10 would be a great improvement in those. Many people have expressed the opinion that this is terrific because you can think of having one ring doing Higgs physics and one ring doing TT bar physics and one ring doing W threshold and one ring doing this and one ring doing that. A similar argument that you hear from linear collider people who tell you all the things they can do. For all of those things, we have to keep in mind that you don't do them all at once. And here in particular, you don't get to use muons for more than one purpose. And so you have to keep in mind that these experiments have to be sequential or interleaved. You don't get to do them all at once and have some reality about that. Even modest polarization can be very useful. 20%, as I said, is the sort of natural level of polarization. You can certainly get more at the expense of luminosity. And if you build in the ability to control that separately for mu pluses and mu minuses, reversible on demand and so on, you can think of lots of things that that would improve. Now, in contrast to the colliders, I find that the single muon ring devices don't seem to lack intensity. With the number of muons that are talked about, if that can be achieved, certainly the fluxes of neutrinos are very impressive and would allow you to think about very interesting experiments. So those capabilities seem, for the moment, better matched to the demands of the physics that you might do. And the final word is to keep our attention on the ultimate goal, which is to think about this as a path to very high-energy lepton colliders for the big question. Thanks very much. I think that for the moment, these crucial technology questions can be addressed piecewise. There's an experiment at Brookhaven to measure the yields of pions and the muons that come from that. There's an experiment that's been sort of scoped out and presented to various committees by all of these people, but I think would be done at Fermilab to test the ionization cooling. Various other pieces, like the crucial question of a target that will survive, that are being looked at. So I think for now, over the next couple of years, there's plenty for the accelerator physicists to do looking one piece at a time. It's like the linear collider research of a decade or so ago, where this group of people did final focus and this group of people did this and that. I think that's the point that we're at. So I haven't thought beyond that.
Do you think that after a couple of years of essentially these experiments about a small machine being built, that will be able to, say, provide a reliable cost for a multi-TUV machine?
I don't know whether I'd believe that. I think you'd at least know where you stood, whether the whole thing had collapsed or not. So I guess what I would like to see, and you know, I'm just a spectator, not a participant in these things, what I'd like to see is those pieces go forward so that 2 years from now we know whether the whole idea disintegrates for our generation or not. I'd also like to see in parallel a serious study of what it would take to build the front end, the hot proton source, and maybe collection of muons, because I think of that as possibly a collection of physics experiments in the short term rather than a long-term program. And I'd like to know whether that's something that's thinkable for the next 5 years or so, 7 years. Raleigh.
If you go to a higher energy, like a few TUV, at some point you get to the point where the computer back higher.
That's right.
Do you know what that is?
They think that that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 TeV per beam. Well, you know, you put it on, David's right, you put it on a tower in the middle of nowhere, the neutrinos going through the atmosphere don't do anything, right? See, I mean, the whole problem is if you put up a wall to protect yourself from the neutrinos, you die. And so you don't want the wall to be there. So it's reversed from our normal situation. That's true. Yes, now, no, because as I say, you know, the column depth of your body, no, the column depth of your body is 10 to the minus 11th probability for a neutrino to interact, right? So maybe there's a little frisson or something, but it's not to worry. Let me just say to Raleigh that people have thought about, you know, how you would do this, or the magnetic field configurations that you could use to get rid of the stray muons. Could you have the machine undulating up and down so you don't have everything coming in one place? You know, once you say disk of death, you get everybody's attention. But I don't think it's our immediate problem.
Pentagon.
I'm trying to assimilate the last part of your talk, and it is more or less that a muon storage ring is way better than the best focusing horn. In old-style neutrino beam, you build this horn.
That's right.
And a storage ring is way better than the best horn you could ever build.
Yes.
It's just you've got the emittance of the muons way down, so your neutrinos are focused, and you keep them for a lot longer to use them for decay.
That's right.
So that's sort of a really
nice
idea. Right. And they were sort of well-defined energy.
Well-defined.
There is
not a beautiful source of neutrinos.
Right.
Much better.
And you don't have to worry about having kaons or not having kaons in the beam and things like that. So it's a very different situation. And as I say, it becomes interesting if you can get enough to make it interesting.
You can play tricks with the muons and anti-muons, presumably, any number.
Right, and you know, fool with their polarizations because you can flip them around at that low momentum. And stuff like that.
It almost sounds like that might justify that ring anyway, right? And is that part of your point that you could?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. What I don't know, you know, if that costs a few hundred million dollars, it's a nice big experiment. If it costs $10 billion, it's not appealing. You know, there is a calculus in these things always.
There must be something. Yeah, $10 billion.
I believe that's crazy.
Impressive solenoid will haul 20 meters. And how long is it? 100 meters long and 20 meters wide. Is that the Tesla field?
No. That was 20 centimeters. The opening is not gigantic.
Okay. All right. Okay. So it sounds like an amazing magnetic axial.
It's pretty amazing. It's funny you should mention that. I was reminded when I saw this thing that when I was a sophomore in college on some physics test, I was given the problem of keeping a beam from getting away, and I guess I failed to invent strong focusing, but my solution was to have a solenoid going the whole length of it. So. I don't know to what extent that's been addressed, and also it's clear that the, I mean, I think of using 8 Tesla magnets for the these rings. The load of synchrotron radiation isn't gigantic, but it's not negligible either. So I don't know how much that's been thought through or whether they've just done order of magnitude estimates on that.
Is there any theoretical interest in electron muon collisions for some lepton number violating thing? Is there a, have I thought about this?
Has anybody thought about it? I can't say, but
you can reject it instantly.
But no, but people have written papers about it.
In your long-range oscillation experiments, what kind of mass scale of oscillations do you have?
It depends. I had one. Okay. You pick your energy. Okay, so you could arrange to either go out with much greater sensitivity in sine squared 2 theta or in delta m squared. And there's another design, well, not design.
Jeff, or Chris, where's the atmospheric neutrino coming in?
Oh. We don't know. You know, kind of here.
Kind of there. The problem is that Minos, the cutoff of Minos may be just above.
That, there we go. Okay, that's what I think.
That's right. That's right.
But it's highly confused.
There is, this I think is for 20 GeV. There's another notion of using a really low energy ring, 1.5 GeV, say, with a detector only a kilometer or so away on the Fermilab site. So it's short baseline, but L over E is getting small. And it would, I mean, at least at the level of a physics problem to think about, it looks like you have very interesting capabilities and a lot of flexibility in tuning L over E for this sort of device. So I will spend some time thinking about this. That's what I can say. Thanks a lot.